Blog Talk Radio.
Have you ever wondered why it's happening again?
Welcome to Mindshifters Radio with your co-host, the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice, and his wife Jeannie. Michael and Jeannie share with you the wisdom of the ancient Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. They offer tools and support 5 days a week. They will support you in building a solid foundation within yourself to live in pure love. In Aramaic, Rachma. Michael is the author of Why Is This Happening to Me Again? For more information on Michael and Jeannie, please visit www.whyagain.com. And now your co-host, the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael and Jeannie Rice.
To the brightness within you and the truth that is rooted within me.
Hi, and welcome to Mindshifters Radio with the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice. I'm your co-host, Jeannie Rice, and we welcome you to the show. Today is Monday, September the 8th, 2014. And this is Parent Teacher Talk Monday, and I believe we have Suzanne with us today, which is awesome. And our call-in number is 646-200-4169. Press 1, and that puts you in queue to talk to us. And we'd love to hear your comments and your questions, because then that makes this your show. Welcome, Michael.
Thank you, dear heart. An awesome day here in the Ozarks. We are complete with our intensive. We shuttled people back to the airport on Saturday and kind of got off the farm for a day yesterday, went into the big city of Branson to do lunch and a movie. So we're back and packing up, getting ready to hit the road for St. Louis next Sunday. We'll be speaking in St. Louis at Washington University at the Newman Center. Free Why Is This Happening to Me Again workshop on Sunday afternoon. Then by the following Sunday, we'll be up with Dr. Tim in Woodstock, Illinois. Looking forward to having a week to hang out with you, Tim, if you're with us this morning. It will be a delight to see your sweet face, and your support is greatly appreciated. The pressure was on the last 3 or 4 days of the intensive. We just had so much to cover and so much processing. We had 12 teachers at this particular Laws of Living intensive, and with 12 teachers in the space that was created, there was so much processing that we could have opened up and done a 60-day intensive with the group, and at the end of 60 days, I don't think we'd have been finished because it was just so much energy moving and so much awesome stuff happening, just fabulous, fabulous results. So thank you that last couple of days, or the last couple of days, taking care of the show for us so that we could stay focused in the energy that was moving. And here we are, ready for a new phase in the process as we get back on the road, which we'll do probably by Thursday. And so we appreciate everybody that chooses to join us every day that you choose to join us. And our Laws of Living intensive was it covered so much territory. I'd like to offer appreciation and accolades to Rex, who came down for the intensive and actually co-taught it with me, and so that was kind of cool. It's been many years since I had a partner in teaching that, and so it was really wonderful to have Rex here, and wonderful to. See, you know, Rex and I have worked together now for over 30 years, and he's become more deeply and deeply involved in facilitating people with this work. And so having him as part of the intensive and the support and the different perspective and energy that he offered out of his comprehension of the Laws of Living course, which he's been working with these tools and these principles for the 3-plus decades that I've known him. So it's pretty awesome, Rex, to have you here if you're on the show today. And we are delighted to have you on our team, and we're delighted to be on your team as we deliver this first century Aramaic tool of forgiveness to every mind, heart, and being on the planet. And one of the things that strikes me at this moment that I'd just like to put out there to everybody who's joining us today, as we think about the essence and the presence of human life. You know, our definition of a human being is a pretty simple one. It doesn't mean somebody who's got a body. Having what we call a body does not make one human. And one of the topics that came up in the intensive several times was oftentimes people's excuse for maladaptive behavior was, well, you know, I'm only human. It's like, no, actually, that's non-human behavior. When we do the insanity, the hostility, the fear, the grief, the rage, the pain, we're really in a non-human mode. And hold a newborn child, you know what the human mode is. It is that awesome, active presence of love that we all come in as, and the world calls us out of it very quickly. The world tends to teach us the fear, the rage, the guilt, the hostility, the subtleties of insanity, that is, the subtleties of a loveless mind. In this work, I define an insane mind as a mind without the activity of love in it. And as you look around, that leaves us with a whole lot of insane minds running our world, especially. And what if the first requirement for being a politician and a leader in the world was you had to have cultivated your own human life and function out of it? Would that be awesome or what? And most people say, oh, well, now, Michael, you're overstating the case. Excuse me. I don't think we're overstating the case at all. Actually, there were two gentlemen who did a thing called the Stability Project. We talked about this before. And these two gentlemen in particular went to and lobbied the 535 members of Congress and the 50 governors of the state. So 585 people for 2 years, these two guys lobbied them to sign a simple civility pledge. And as I would see it, the civility pledge would be, I pledge to function as a human being. Basically, they just said, you know, pledge to function in a civil way in your public intercourse with other officials and with your position in the government. 2 years, these two guys lobbying got three people who were willing and interested in signing a commitment to function like a human being, to function out of a civil mind, or we could say a human mind, the active presence of love. And so there are so many calls, to that insanity that the world offers us every day. Our own minds have been brainwashed to function out of the insanity. Our own minds have been brainwashed to function out of hostility, fear, grief, rage, sadness, hatred, vengeance, and all of the insanity that runs the world. Actually, the thing that that brings this topic to mind in particular, I have a Course in Miracles app on my phone, and one of the quotes that came across the Course in Miracles app a couple of days ago was, why should you listen to the endless insane calls you think are made upon you when you can know the voice for love is in you? And when you look at how many times we have, as small children and growing up, been violated with the rage and the guilt and the fear of the adults around us, and then growing into adulthood, becoming adults who do exactly the same thing. I remember this is probably 2 years ago now, but Jeannie and I were in a store, and as we were walking out of the store, I had checked out, and she was in the line. I went out to get the van, and she was going to check out, and in front of her was about a 2.5 or 3-year-old boy in a cart. And he wanted some grapes that were, you know, mom was buying, and got fussy, you know, cried. And somehow Jeannie, as they were packing up the cart, got ahead of him. So she was standing at the door waiting for me to pull the van up, and heard this 2.5 or 3-year-old boy in his mother's arms as they walked out of the store crying to mom, "Mom, please don't beat me. I love you." When you think about that, and I know that Jeannie went into tears, actually, that I think it was right on the spot, she picked up the phone and called her son.
apologize for every time that you've ever called in some form to hostility or fear. And I certainly, for all the times I didn't know any better and offered that call to hostility or fear to my children, to my family, I certainly heartily apologize for not knowing any better. And as we begin to really function as human beings, how often does the world call for us to deal with each other through our rage, our guilt, our grief, and our pain? And how often do we suffer physically when we do that? And, of course, we dissociate our suffering, our physical suffering, from what we've done to ourselves by sending out an energy that's less than love to others. But sooner or later, we have to start to connect those two things and recognize that every time I experience pain in my body, it's because I have called from within me, I've called forward an energy of some form of hostility or fear and attempted to deal with the world through that energy. And I would offer that that is the only thing that will ever destroy our human bodies. And so when we have been trained into calling that forward so often and feel like that's something that's valuable within our relationships with our spouses, with our children, with our parents, with the people around us, are we willing, are our work here in this, why is this happening to me again, is to be willing to give up that call to hostility or fear, grief, rage, or pain, and to really, truly function as human beings with each other, to function out of that active presence of love, which, you know, if we come from family systems that hold all sorts of family systems, religious systems, cultural systems that hold all sorts of hostility and fear, it's not an easy commitment to keep. It's a big order of work. There was one person in our intensive this past couple of weeks, and it was interesting to watch how his body would go into pain when his hostility would come up. And it just makes such a direct correlation when you get to watching yourself and when your structure's feeding back pain to you to stop and go, what have I dissociated from here that I think this is physical? What was the energy of violation that I put into my form that I'm now unwilling to embrace with love and move through? And as I decide, which it's not easy to make that decision because it's not something that's been structured into us very often, and so I may have to really, truly effort calling forth the spiritual faculty of choice to choose to do differently, to choose to embrace everything in me that is less than the love that I am, and to start to connect when I go into pain, what have I done to violate the integrity of my own structure that causes that pain? What do I need to embrace? What do I need to pull forward into awareness from within me? And as I do that, I get to heal layer upon layer, layer upon layer, layer upon layer. And we're here to support each person who connects with the show, each person who calls in. The whole essence of the work is, are you willing to let go of that fear thought? Are you willing to look at and question that hostility for thought? Are you willing to let go of that grief, that rage, that sadness, that terror, that trauma? And, of course, your mind will always justify that there's a good reason to hold on to it. After all, don't they deserve my rage? And after watching the way some people behave, I say, you know, I watch them. I agree with you. They deserve your rage wholeheartedly. But the real question is not, do they deserve your rage? The real question is, do you? Because you're the one who's going to get the original. They're going to get the carbon copy. And most of the calls that take us into this hostility or fear come from somewhere in our distant past, a raging mind somewhere in our past, a parent, a preacher, a spouse, a friend, an enemy, and we integrate that call as though, and we make it our own as though it's worth going into that call for hostility or fear. Again, the quote from the Course, why should you listen to the endless insane calls you think are made upon you when you can know the voice for love is in you? And so our challenge today is, especially with it being Parent Teacher Talk Monday, is to really come forward, especially when our children challenge us, to come forward as that awesome active presence of love, and to teach the child who perhaps is reflecting some of our own genes when they go into their disturbance and upset and pain and trauma, and invite them to come back to the presence of love over and over and over again. And sometimes, you know, it takes creating that invitation a dozen times a minute to get there. But what a worthy invitation to come back to love instead of justifying why I should be in that hostility or fear mode. And so that's our purpose here. And, Jeannie, do we have Dr. Tim with us today?
We do, and he's on.
Oh, cool. Well, let's say hello to the young man. See how you be, sir.
I'm doing well, thank you. I'm glad to hear that you're all taking a little downtime to recover from that very intense processing that was happening over the past 17 or 18 days.
It was definitely intense.
Well, I hope that everybody involved knows to give themselves some tender, loving care and allow the benefits of that intense work to sink in and give themselves the sustenance and rest they need to integrate it.
Well, it's pretty awesome with 12 teachers here, Tim, when something would pop for somebody. You know, the second night, there were a couple of new folks that some of them arrived were in quite a bit of trauma. And the second evening, we kind of opened the space because things were, I mean, right from the introductions, we went right into deep process the first night. But the second night, it was really awesome to just step back. I sort of, we did a little bit of introduction and I sort of stepped back and left people to go into, learning the love exchange process with each other. And we had, 16 people here, and it took about, you know how the love exchange goes, you know, 10 minutes, 15 minutes, and people have got a hold of it. But the kind of support that showed up, the kind of energy that was moving, it was over 2 hours, and everybody just kind of gravitated into groups, and it was just like this blossoming of this presence of love from each person that was there supporting, you know, each person who, you know, didn't know the work yet, wasn't here, hadn't been here before, and so really didn't have a handle on the work. It was just awesome to just watch how that space opened. And, you know, there were, I think, 4 different groups of people that kind of gravitated toward each other and were just together for that 2 hours in this. It for me, stepping back and just tapping into and watching the energy was just like watching an amazing dance take place and being fed and nurtured by it. It was just fabulous. And then, of course, Rex was here, and Rex did just some fabulous work with people in teaching and processing, and so it was all just so delightful and intense.
And intense. I hear it. And
yeah.
It's always great to hear that people are willing to step up and do their work and do their own processing at times like that, because it's when the call is strongest in me to back off and have a series of excuses come up. And so it's delightful to hear that people were there and for the most part willing to step up and do their work and further their own process so that then they can teach others, which is just what we need.
Pretty cool. Pretty cool.
And speaking of intense, it's pretty intense to do parenting. And do we have Suzanne with us today?
Well, I thought it was
Suzanne.
It may not be, but it's a 314, and they've had their hand up since the very beginning. So let's see who it is.
I think that's probably Mary Jo Corcoran.
It is.
Are you with us, Mary Jo?
I am. Can you hear me?
Oh, there you go. You just kicked in. Your voice was kind of slipping in and out there for a second. Welcome.
Okay. Good day to you.
And for those who perhaps haven't met you on the show previously, maybe you want to just briefly introduce yourself and what you're doing with kids and with parents. I think it's pretty awesome the path that you've taken as a former school principal and what you're doing. So perhaps you could share that a little bit.
Sure. I was in the public school system for 25 years and worked with pretty much all ages. Primarily, the early childhood group really grabbed me, and I realized how much children are forming during those first 8 years and the importance of really great education and support to parents and educating them on child development. So I've been a certified parent coach now for about 10 years and have my own company. It's called All About Kids. And I work also with Anheuser-Busch on a program called Family Talk, which I provide information to parents about how to talk to their children at different ages, because as parents, our role shifts from teacher to facilitator to be more coach-like by the time our children are teenagers. So I give lots of examples on how to talk to your kids with open-ended questions as a parent to not just enhance the relationship, but deepen the conversation.
Cool. Give us an example of that open-ended question process.
Times, especially in the early years, as parents, we tell our children what to do, and then we ask yes-no questions. Did you do your homework? Did you clean your room? Those are all yes-no. And yes-no questions serve a purpose, but not a purpose for encouraging more communication and deeper conversations. So because once you've answered yes or no, that's the end. There's a big period at the end of that sentence. So in order to allow our children to not just brainstorm, but problem solve and all those other, I would say, higher level of thinking, we ask open-ended questions like, how do you feel about school? Tell me, what would you do if your friends at school offered something like drugs or alcohol to you? You know, asking open-ended questions. What would you do if? All those kinds of questions cause a child to, one, feel much more respected because they're able to give their opinion, and two, be able to go to a deeper level of thinking and actually get into problem solving and looking at the whole picture rather than just saying, yes, I cleaned my room, or yes, I did this. So it just leads to so much more. And as parents, we tend to stay in that yes-no mode. And that's why we wonder why they don't talk to us as much. And it's basically because we're either telling them to do something or we're asking them those very closed sentences or questions.
Right. Cool. Well, that sounds like a really awesome process to engage. And I know that in our Laws of Living course, we do a lot of work with speech and what we call regulatory speech, and we point out in the course that by about the age of 13, the child has pretty much solidified, and at that age of 13, when it's solidified, it's relatively impervious to change unless one has the tools and really the willingness to go inside and start to crack some of those unconscious dynamics open, that system, that speech system, is pretty solidified. And so that's the point at which we do exactly what you had said earlier, is we suggest, okay, so you're a parent directing the child from a young child, and as you move toward the age of 13, get ready to switch from director to coach, because you just, once that speech system solidifies, you can't be the director anymore, or it's going to create all kinds of, you know, what typically in this culture I looked at is the teenager's problem. It's not the teenager's problem at all, but it's, I think, a great degree that the parent hasn't realized, oh, we should have done a rite of passage here, allow this child to pass into adulthood, turn them over to the community to be responsible to the larger community, and now be here there as their support and coach rather than the parental voice that tries to direct them.
That's right on. Yep.
Cool. Well, anything on your mind in particular to share with us beyond that? I think that's an awesome piece, the whole idea of focusing on open-ended questions, and I could certainly see how that would be useful right from the very early stages of a child talking to keep them in a conversation rather than that yes-no directiveness that sometimes we tend to do.
I had a coaching session with a 16-year-old girl last week, and it was so interesting to me because the mom called me and she said, my daughter just wants to talk to you. She hasn't really been talking to me. She's been, you know, kind of had an attitude. And so I went in and I had coached her about 4 years ago. And I asked her what was going on. And the way she described things was that basically she tries so hard and she doesn't feel like her parents listen. The same kind of, you know, a lot of teenagers feel that way. And it was so interesting because, one, I tried a new concept of just shifting her thoughts around that and by actually using a phrase called new choice. When she told me her story, I asked her to shift it a bit and say, oh, I try very hard and I do my best rather than I try so hard and nothing happens. So she shifted the thought first. And then when mom came in, it was interesting because as she was telling her story to mom, mom kept trying to, she was doing, we do a lot with listening and levels of listening. Mom kept trying or thought that she was listening to her. And what was happening is that she was trying to just connect with her. And the way she connected with her is by saying, oh, I know exactly what you mean. This is what happened to me when I was younger. And so the teenager kept saying, you are not listening to me. She goes, yeah, I am. I'm telling you, I had the same thing happen to me. And she'd go into her story. And so finally, I kind of said, okay, so here's what's happening. Mom, you're trying to relate to her story by telling your story. And your daughter needs to be heard, not by you telling your story, but by you saying, oh, so this is how you feel. This is what you want. So we talked a lot about levels of listening and the sense of being heard and how important that is for teenagers, not to fix the situation, but to just hear them.
Cool. Sounds like powerful intervention.
It was very good stuff.
Yeah. Sweet. Dr. Tim, do you have any input at this moment?
Well, just that I agree, you know, one of the more powerful things we can do is that questioning, not interrogating,
right,
but asking people questions to which they have to give a considered answer, and a simple yes or no doesn't fit the bill. The other thing, there's a very powerful approach that comes through the love and logic technique, which is to constantly give children choices and just make sure that the parent can live with whatever choice the child chooses. And then we're doing just what was talked about. We're giving them an opportunity to problem solve. We're giving them an opportunity to demonstrate their ability to, one, make a choice, and number two, live with the consequences. And the more we do that, the more it builds that ability in the child, and they gain confidence at it. And then later on, when they're going to be on their own as teenagers, they make better choices because they've had a lot of practice. And they've learned over time that they're going to have to live with the consequences. So they think about it a little bit more before they make the choice.
Well, I think you make a really awesome point there too, Dr. Tim, and that is that we have to be willing to support the child in dealing with the consequences rather than try to jump in and fix it for them, take care of it for them, do it for them. I know that in raising children, something I learned early is that parents are not for leaning on, they're for making leaning unnecessary, and if a child can do something for themselves, best is to, rather than jumping in and disabling them. And, you know, a lot of parents don't realize that when they step in and take over for the child, whatever age the child is, and do it for them rather than support them doing it for themselves, they weaken, they inhibit the ability of the child to develop new skills. And so the cost of developing those new skills to the child becomes higher and higher and higher the older they get. And some parents just can't ever step back and let their child experience the consequence without trying to rush in and fix it for them. And that can be so disabling.
One of my favorite phrases, Michael, is what we overprotect, we make weak.
Yeah. That's a good way to say it. I never thought of it that way, but that's an absolutely an awesome way to say it. And so many parents think they're doing their kids a favor by stepping
right
in and taking care of everything for them, speaking for them, taking care of, you know, even the youngest child can take care of their own business matters. You know, they need to put a stamp on an envelope and put it in the mailbox. If we support the child learning how to do that, how to address an envelope rather than, oh, here, I'll take care of that for you, honey. Or, you know, just such some of the smallest tasks that the child thinks they're doing a favor, and or the parent, pardon me, thinks they're doing the child a favor, and they're really not. But the parent just, because of their own issues and unresolved positions in life, just can't seem to step back and support the child in learning what they need to learn. Because
I would I was just going to say that what I've noticed about a lot of parents that do overprotect or overdo or overaccommodate, sometimes they do that because it's quicker and easier for them. And sometimes it's because they don't know how to experience their children in a way in which there's that tension for learning. So there's a little bit of struggle, and parents aren't, they tend to not love to watch their children struggle at all. And so any struggle makes them go, let me just do it for you.
And
but they rob
company,
their children of the experience.
Yeah, and I think that's the discomfort and the issue of the parent, that the parent is unwilling to resolve within themselves, unwilling to look back at the times in their lives where that was what happened to them, and they just can't deal with it, and so they keep plugging in and, as you say, weakening instead of strengthening.
And one of the things that we find, one of the largest factors in that, one of the largest negative energies is fear.
Right.
And this is where if the parent can learn a tool like forgiveness and actually go in and dismantle their own energies and thoughts and false realities around fears, often based in past work or in generational work, then they can come into the situation with their child from a loving place, as Michael was talking about in the intro. But it is a huge, huge roadblock to good parent-child interactions, to have fear be the lens through which the parent is viewing the child.
It's true. And the opposite of fear is really faith. Yeah. You know, having the faith in your children that you know they can get through some of those more tense points.
Well, I think also the trust that if they fall, that their falling is, metaphorically, their falling is part of their learning process and what allows them to stand on stronger feet and be more balanced. The parent
right.
who never allows a child to fall, the child never fully develops that total balance and the total ability, all the muscles, all the neural connections required to be solid on their own 2 feet, you know, and emotionally, financially, you know, work-wise, you know, responsibility for things happening in one's life. A lot of parents really don't realize how much they're disabling the child.
I agree.
Let's see if Julie is with us. Jeannie, is Julie with us today?
Yes, she is. Hold on, and I will turn her on, and then we also have another hand up as well. Well, Julie was with us. Let me find her. She must have disappeared off the switchboard. Julie, if you're still on there, press 1 on your phone. Okay, I guess she's not on there now. Do you want to take the other caller?
Sure, let's say hello.
Okay, I think it might be Jim. It's a 417 number. You're on the air.
Hello, it is Jim.
Hey there, young man. Welcome.
Oh, I'll tell you. I'm back in sunny Sarasota, packing up my car, giving away some stuff to the Women's Resource Center in town for some, hopefully for some single parent mom. But what's really interesting and what I want to talk about, and I hope Mary Jo is still on the line. I've never met her before. But last night, coming flying back, about 20 minutes left in the flight, gentleman who is sitting in the window seat, I'm in the aisle seat, seat between us is empty. We've both been reading through most of the flight. He set the book down that he was reading, and I couldn't help but notice the title. The title of the book was Setting Limits, subtitled How to Handle the Willful Child.
Hmm.
And I, you know, in sales we have a 3-foot rule. Engage anybody that's within 3 foot of you. And I said, oh, here's an opportunity. So I just engaged him and asked his permission to give him some thoughts and feedback, and we had a great conversation. I wound up giving him my commitment bookmark and invited him, gave him the web address, which he pulled up on his cell phone. Can you hear me okay?
Loud and clear.
Okay. Should have checked that sooner. Anyway, it turns out he facilitates a spirit-based addiction group in Springfield. He was flying to Sarasota to visit his parents on Siesta Key. But he's got this 10-year-old girl who he described as a very willful child. And he and his wife are, he didn't state this, my words, my interpretation. They're kind of at wit's end with how to deal with this child. And I thought, wow, setting limits. I said, you know, I just came from an intensive and they described Heartland and your work, Michael. And I said, that sounds to me to be about 180 degrees the opposite of what you might consider doing. I said, and I happen to have with me the personal code evaluation sheet, and I pulled it out and showed it to him. I said, here are the 10 things that we focused on for the last 16 days, and take a look at this. Will, I said, what we focused on is helping people increase their will, not decrease it. And it's out of will that we're able to make conscious choices. And, you know, I'll give him a short infomercial on that and goal setting and what have you. So he said to me, you think it's as simple as setting goals? I said, no, that's just a piece of it. I said, but I invite you to call into the radio show and press 1 and ask the question. Mike will be happy to address it. But anyway, so I just thought it was, and this is after spending 20 minutes with a cab driver who I exchanged information with. He was also within the 3-foot range, and he's very interested in visiting Heartland as a result of this 15, 20-minute ride to the airport. It was a very, very cool trip back, needless to say. And on top of that, the Dallas Cowboys lost, which really made my day.
Okay.
sidebar. Anyway, so I really appreciate your comments and Mary Jo's about, and I don't know if he is on this call or not. I neglected to tell him, it didn't occur to me to tell him that Monday is Teacher Child Day, but I really believe he'll call in. So if you get a call in from a fellow who asks about a 10-year-old willful child, you'll know who it is. But anyway, I'll sit back and just listen to your comments about that.
Yeah, my first comment would be that probably as opposed to asserting more control and being willful with the child, because, you know, as we point out in the Laws of Living Intensive, the ego has a cheap copy of everything that's real in the spiritual dimension, and the spiritual faculty of will, its cheap copy is willpower. And you can bet that we've got probably a battle of wills going on, of willpower, not actually will. And probably the most important tool that that this gentleman could learn in that situation and could offer the daughter, if the daughter is willing to hear it, is how to strengthen one of the other aspects of the spiritual faculty of will, as opposed to setting goals, doing exactly the opposite, but learning how to cancel goals. And if he were to start to cancel the goals that when his child becomes what he calls willful, if he can learn to start canceling his own goals and see where his power struggles were with his power person and how that has impacted his life and the way he's raised his child, he'll very likely have a chance to process through some internal hostility or fear of his own and start to move that whole relationship in a different direction with his daughter. So I hope we do hear from him, because that's a really big challenge in this culture. And yes, the culture says, well, all we have to do is assert more control, then we'll be okay. And of course, the child learns what they live, so the child sees, so the way to win in your life, especially with your power person, the way they do it with me is to assert more control, so I'll just assert more control and see how it works. Now we get that battle of willpower going on, and it just creates crazy time, as opposed to, there are five different things that will, as a spiritual faculty, can do. Only one of them is set goals. The other one, or one of the most important ones, which keys into the forgiveness process, of course, is the canceling of goals. And when one strengthens all five, you know, take a child and teach them truly how to develop their will and utilize all five things that will can do in a well-rounded way, and the willful child will disappear. And the child with power and compassion will come forward in a whole new way. But, you know, it's really sad that these ideas have been around for thousands of years, and yet they've been hidden. They've been disappeared from the planet, the technology, the laws by which the mind works. And when we talk about laws of living, you know, most people, it's kind of the same will game with the king. Most people think that, law means that the king has the power and sends people with guns if one doesn't like what if the king doesn't like what one is doing. And the opposite is true of law, and it's simply an understanding of the way things work. When we teach our children a complete 100% free and open understanding of how the energy systems in life works, the child, instead of doing things out of fear, we call it, you know, propitiation. T.S. Eliot's definition is awesome. Propitiation is doing the right thing for the wrong reason. When we teach a child through our control of will and our intimidation and all of the power games that parents can play, that we can control the child, then we teach the child to be a controller and teach them that that's the way to win in the world. But then the child goes out and starts doing, perhaps doing the right things because they've been frightened into it, but every person who does the right things for the wrong reasons creates disease processes within their bodies and their minds every time they do it. Teach the child how the whole system actually works. And, of course, we can only teach the child if we know how it works ourselves. You know, the word discipline in the culture is looked at as, you know, properly beat up, but the word comes from the word disciple. It means properly taught. If we empower the child 1,000% to know exactly how the world works, not inhibit them in some area with terrorism, with fear, with hostility. You know, oh, child, don't do that. That's sin. That will get you in trouble. You teach a child that, and the child has the inclination to do that simply because they've been programmed with guilt about it, and it just creates such mass confusion. So I would hope that if that gentleman is on, that he would push one and see what support we can be. I'm sure with Dr. Tim, with Mary Jo, with Jeannie, with you, and I don't know whether Rex is here, we'd just be delighted to be of support. One of the beauties of our whole community is the number of people all over the globe that are holding the space for the healing of all of these issues that you know, that we all have.
Michael, two other suggestions I made. We did have a conversation about canceling goals, and I talked about canceling a goal every night before you go to bed and then resetting it the next morning. Just a brief conversation about that. But the other recommendation I made to him was to go on the website and look up Healing Children, Loving Children, Julie's book. And I explained to him that Julie is, you know, lives at Heartland and that she's a retired school teacher and wrote this great book. As a matter of fact, you'll get the newest recently edited version, recently updated version. And that could be a great tool to help you work through these issues with your daughters. Just the title just jumped out at me, and like it hit me in the face. Setting limits. Do you really want to set limits for this child that probably is very, very bright and could be bored with what's going on in life and not having enough mental stimulation? And I mean, I'm not a psychologist, but there's all kinds of reasons why she could be willful, and many of them could be very good.
Yeah, and at the age of 10, this is an ideal time to teach her what will actually means and to support her and empower her in exercising her will. And if the parent does that, as opposed to trying to use the parent's own willpower, which models we're going to do willpower rather than will, it just leads to more trouble. Dr. Kim, you have any thoughts in that direction?
Well, just that you know, if you don't get too hooked up on the terminology, everything we're talking about that helps a child, even at 3 or 4 or 5 years old, realize that they are making choices and that those choices do have consequences, and they can learn to get better and better at their choices, and that they can have the strength to cope with whatever the consequences are, then we're doing them a great service. If we try to train them that they have to be dependent upon us, they have to be beholden to us, they have to be under our thumb, we're doing them a great disservice. So whatever terminology you want to use, the more we train these children into their power to make decisions and to handle the consequences of their decisions, the better service we're doing them.
For sure. How about for you, Mary Jo? Do you have any thoughts?
You know, I think that it's so much easier for children, teens, tweens to be allowed to make choices and handle the consequences. Like on that side, I think it's once a parent chooses to do that, it can go very smoothly. But I think for a lot of parents, there's so much resistance to that because it's the unknown. And most parents have not ever experienced that type of parenting. And so, again, we talk a little bit about fear, but it's also like dipping your toe in the water sometimes for parents. And if it doesn't work or if something happens from it, a lot of parents will just revert right back to their old systems of thinking and their old ways. So I really do think it's about parent education and support to allow them to see what greater good could come out of this, not just for them, though, but for their children and for them. Because I do think that a lot of parents are just, you know, as if you have an oldest child and they're starting their teens, they've never experienced that other than their own experience. And so they bring all those, exactly what you said, all those memories, all those generations of pain to that situation. And a lot of parents just don't have the support. So I do think that the parent support part could change everything.
Yes. Yeah, I'm in full agreement on that. For sure.
Jeannie, do you have any thoughts to add to the topic? Hello, Jeannie. Is your mute button on?
Yes, it was. we do have Julie with us, and we also have a hand up.
Oh, cool. Well, let's check with Julie and see if she has any comments on the conversation with all the kids. I know that Julie has shared with me before some of the willful children that she's worked with, and they end up becoming her best students. Maybe you want to share a little bit about how that looks from your end, Julie.
Hey there, I don't even know if I was on. Am I on?
You are.
Okay. Well, you know, I really work with processing the children that were willful and really working with them and nurturing them and, you know, teaching them how to be responsible and how I also taught them about the law of cause and effect and what they send out that they will receive and that they were actually participating in a behavior that was possibly off the mark. So, I was really working towards empowering them while I was empowering myself. And to be quite honest,
right.
I didn't always know how to empower them if I was triggered. And then I would have to do my work and see how my intuition would kick in and so that I could be present for them and support them in their healing process. I think the best thing that I ever did was to, teach them the forgiveness tool and teach them how to take responsibility for what was really happening for them. And I noticed one other thing is parents often feed the energy by reacting to the energy. When a child in my room threw a temper tantrum, I would say, wait a minute, and then I would go over to them and I would tell them, I said, I see that you're upset. And it appears to me that you might be angry. When you feel done with this, you can come over and talk to me. So I walked away rather than feeding it or reacting to the behavior, giving them an opportunity kind of to process it out, and then knowing that they're not going to get my attention, also deleted the energy. And then once that was happening, usually what would happen, then the child would, after a while, stop and then come over and talk to me about what was going on. It was a lot better than to feed what is off target. Now, I'm down at the Heart Center kind of working around, so I haven't really participated in the whole radio show, so I hope that would be this contribution would be beneficial.
Absolutely, right on target, Julie. Awesome input. Right on target. I think that's a really good point of letting the child know that they get their attention by positive communication rather than through negative behaviors, because I think a lot of kids, I heard one psychologist years ago that referred to it as the soggy cereal principle, and that the child would go for a soggy cereal when it's hungry, where the adult would wait for the next meal, the child would go for the soggy cereal, and too often the children learn that the only time they get attention is through the negativity. And it's really sad, especially being in the prison system, and we see people who are still functioning out of a 3 or 4-year-old's mind and going through all kinds of pain and trauma and punishment simply because they're looking for that attention. So that's a really good point.
Uh-huh.
Cool. Well, Jimmy, did you say you had another hand up?
Yes, I do. And it's area code 251. You're on the air.
Hi, this is Angela. And hi, Dr. Ice. Hi, Jeannie. Hi, everybody.
Welcome.
Thank
How
you.
How are you in Alaska?
Well, actually, I'm in Arizona, and 251 is an Alabama prefix. I lived there 4 years ago. Since went to South Carolina, and now I'm in Phoenix, and totally new situation, and it's bringing up a lot of stuff, and of course, I've noticed that it's, similar situations in the relationship that I've been in the past. And so I know there are lots of gifts, and this is a huge opportunity.
I thought a roadrunner was just a cartoon. I know, it's not real.
Can you guys hear me okay? Can y'all hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
You're kind of fading a little bit toward the end of your conversation there, but we can hear you.
I had to mute another caller. They were still coming through, so you're loud.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. Okay, yeah. So the things that I'm noticing, I'm in a relationship with my boyfriend, and we are now in the same house, and it's bringing up I notice that I get into relationships with men who are weaker than me, I guess. I know that, you know, that's a lie, you know, and that I, you know, should be able to love everybody and really lift everybody up, and that's my goal. It's been so hard to find positive things about him. So,
I noticed that as you start to talk about the difficulty in finding positive things about him, you go into pain.
Okay,
So my input would be that the first order of business is that this pain around weakness is probably projected pain, and it hasn't got to do with his weakness at all. It has to do with the parts of your mind that he's reflecting for you. And so the first order of business for me would be I'd start doing some worksheets around feeling weak and or feeling a need to overpower someone and see where that takes you. And unfortunately, we're down to just a few seconds on the show.
Right.
But
it
is a conversation that I would love to continue and support you with.
Okay.
So
Perfect.
If it works for you, maybe at the opening of the show tomorrow, you could call in right at the opening, and we could get into more detail on how we can support you with this. In the meantime, perhaps if you don't have any worksheets, jump on the website, whyagain.org. Click on the bullseye. The second link is the worksheet process, and maybe do a couple of worksheets around what I've just shared with you, and let's continue the conversation tomorrow. That would be awesome.
That sounds terrific. I've got my worksheets handy. Thank you so much. I'll talk to you guys tomorrow.
All right, blessings. Appreciate you and everybody. Thank you for joining us. We invite you to create the best of your eternal life. It's a great gift to give the world, and bring strength to the show tomorrow. Blessings. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Mind Shifters Radio with the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice, and his wife, Jeannie, who present the internal Aramaic process of forgiveness. Michael and Jeannie are here every Monday through Friday on Earth Angels Radio. For more on Michael and Jeannie, please visit www.whyagain.com. That's www.whyagain.com.